This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and I want to bring you a special episode in which we wrap up the two biggest cases of the Supreme Court term. It's now early July. We know that means that the last term of the Supreme Court is over. And as we've been talking about throughout the season, I think the two biggest cases deal with nationwide injunctions, sometimes referred to as the birthright citizenship case, and Scarametti, which dealt with transgender rights for minors. So without further ado, let's get right into it and talk about those cases. So let's begin with the birthright citizenship / nationwide injunction case. Now, what's the background here? Back on his second day in office, President Trump issued Executive Order 14160, and this sought to restrict recognition of birthright citizenship for certain categories of U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants. Or maybe put more simply, in my view, this executive order sought to undermine birthright citizenship, which is part of the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment, in my view, says that if you're born in this country, then you are a U.S. citizen and the status of your parents does not matter. I should note that that's not just my view, that's the view of the Supreme Court for over 100 years now. So back to the executive order, President Trump issues the executive order and people and groups sue immediately saying this executive order cannot go into effect. It contravenes the Constitution. And three different district court judges agreed and they issued something called nationwide preliminary injunctions. And that means that the executive order about birthright citizenship didn't go into effect anywhere in the country. Again, nationwide means exactly that. Typically, when judges provide relief, what they do is say, you're right, and this executive order won't be applied to you, people in my courtroom. But nationwide injunctions or universal injunctions function in a different way. They previously gave judges much more power to say, there's such a big problem with this executive order that would occur if it went into effect in some jurisdictions that we're just going to have to impose one of these universal injunctions. Now, the Trump administration sought emergency relief from the Supreme Court, but not on the substantive question as to whether or not the executive order was constitutional, but instead on the question of relief, the question of whether or not nationwide injunctions are in fact permissible. And the Trump administration had two main arguments for why nationwide injunctions are not permissible. The first is that they exceed the scope of power under a very old federal statute, the Judiciary Act of 1789. The second is that they exceed the scope of judges' power under the Constitution, under Article 3. So again, the Trump administration not seeking relief from the Supreme Court on that substantive question about whether or not the executive order violates the 14th Amendment, but instead saying we're coming to the Supreme Court asking for, quote, modest relief. And what they were really asking for is tell us that these nationwide injunctions are improper. And largely speaking, this was a win for the Trump administration. But let's get into the details. So again, the issue, the legal issue in the case was, do district courts have authority either under the Judiciary Act of 1789 or under Article 3 of the Constitution to issue these universal or nationwide injunctions, or do they have to be limited to just issuing injunctions based on the parties before them? Now, the holding here is that generally speaking, judges don't have the power to issue nationwide injunctions, as I said. But again, let's talk more about the case. It's written by the newest conservative justice, Justice Amy Coney Barrett. She wrote for a 6-3 majority. The court was divided along ideological lines. And She said nationwide injunctions generally exceed the equitable authority granted by Congress. And therefore, courts can only grant this sort of preliminary relief when an executive order is challenged for the named plaintiffs, for the people walking into that courtroom to sue. So the first thing I want to emphasize is that in my view, this decision is really based on statutory interpretation. Again, what is the power that Congress gave the courts under the Judiciary Act of 1789? It's not, in my view, a constitutional decision. It's not based on what can judges do under Article 3. So why am I emphasizing this? Because my perspective is that if we don't like this, then we should talk in part to our elected representatives and say, pass a new statute that gives federal judges this authority. So let's go back to Justice Barrett's majority for a moment here. Now, what's she really saying? I'm going to quote here. The equitable powers of federal courts are broad but not boundless. They do not extend to issuing relief for the nation as a whole unless Congress clearly says so. Again, I think this decision leaves the door open for Congress, if they want to clearly say federal judges do have this power. I just suspect, as a political matter, Congress likely will not. Now, what's the theory here behind Justice Barrett's opinion? I think it's really the idea that when the Judiciary Act was passed, I'm going to quote again, universal injunctions were unknown. And the idea that the modern usage of universal injunctions is really an anomaly, and it's not supported by the statute, and it's not supported in history. So, what else I think is motivating Justice Barrett? Part of what she's saying here is that nationwide injunctions, again, quote, invite conflicting obligations. So what does that mean? It means that one court might come to one conclusion and say there should be a nationwide injunction. Another court may come to a different conclusion. Okay, but does this mean that if you are a plaintiff, if you want to challenge an executive order, that you can't get broad relief under any circumstances? And I think the answer to that is no. And I want to spell out three specific instances where I think there is still the possibility of getting relief beyond just a judge saying there's a problem with this executive order and therefore it won't be applied to those people in my courtroom. So number one is class actions. If challengers can bring class actions because there's a common set of facts and a common injury, then the court can enjoin, meaning stop conduct as to the entire class. Number two, states. I think there is the possibility that states could bring claims where they say there's no ability for me as a state to get adequate relief unless you impose a nationwide injunction. And the court here talked about the fact that the district court for the District of Massachusetts decided that a universal injunction was necessary to provide the states themselves with complete relief. We declined to take up these arguments in the first instance. The lower court should determine whether a narrower injunction is appropriate. We therefore leave it to them to consider these and any related arguments. What does this mean in plain language? I think what it means is that if states can convince a federal judge that the only way for the state itself to get complete relief is to get a nationwide injunction, then that's still on the table. What would that look like when it comes to birthright citizenship? I think what it looks like is a state saying that if birthright citizenship, if the executive order goes into effect in certain states, then but not others, it's going to be a mess because people obviously travel between states. People cannot have, the states will argue, citizenship in one state, but a lack of U.S. citizenship in another state. And people might, for instance, leave the state to have a child. People might have a child in another state and then move into a different state. And so the states will argue there's all sorts of burdens that can only be remedied if there's a nationwide injunction. Now, third, so we talked about class actions, we talked about states. Third, the Administrative Procedures Act. Now, this is a statute that says to the executive, if you want to impose certain executive actions, for instance, like implement an executive order, then you have to go about it in the right way. Now, just as a reminder, one of the reasons that the Trump administration during the first term wasn't able to end or wind down DACA is that there was an administrative procedures problem. They didn't go about it in the right way. They didn't follow notice and comment. They didn't provide enough procedure. And a number of the cases that challenge President Trump's executive orders are actually based in part on the Administrative Procedures Act. And so the court said, quote, nothing we say today resolves the distinct question whether the Administrative Procedure Act authorizes federal courts to vacate federal agency action, which I think in plain language means that if you convince a federal judge that there is a problem with an executive order and the problem is based on the Administrative Procedures Act, then there's still the possibility that you can get the legal functional equivalent of a nationwide injunction, meaning that that executive order would be vacated automatically and could not be applied anywhere in the country. Okay, so that's the majority, and that is also where I think there are still potentials for broad relief. Now, what about the dissent? We have two very, very strong dissents, one from Justice Sonia Sotomayor, one from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Justice Sotomayor, again, I'm going to read from part of her dissent. Today, the court strips federal courts of the ability to safeguard constitutional rights in the face of nationwide executive overreach. It does so not to protect liberty, but to protect power. Another quote here, when the government acts unlawfully against thousands or millions of people, it is not enough to enjoin it from harming just a few. So I think when it comes to Justice Sotomayor's dissent, she's concerned about different things than the majority is concerned about. The majority is looking at this Judiciary Act and saying federal judges go beyond their lane, go beyond the scope of their given power if they impose these nationwide injunctions. And we as federal judges can only take the power that's given to us. Sotomayor is saying that we need to use this power now because the executive is engaging in, I think Justice Sotomayor's view, unconstitutional behavior. And so we need this tool. Federal judges need this tool in their toolkit. Now, what about Justice Jackson? Justice Jackson says, quote, the majority's cramped view of judicial power transforms courts from guardians of rights to passive observers. It hands immense power to the executive and leaves ordinary Americans to fend for themselves. Last quote, the decision is an existential threat to the rule of law. So again, a very different view of what Justice Jackson and Justice Sotomayor are worried about. Justice Jackson and Sotomayor are saying we need judges here. We need strong judges to check executive overreach. We have Justice Barrett writing for the conservatives saying we need to have federal judges who stay within their prescribed powers. So that is the big nationwide injunction case. I also want to briefly talk about what I think was the other big case of the term, and that's the Skirmiti case. Now, this is obviously a completely different case. We're totally changing gears here. And now we're talking about a Tennessee law. This is a Tennessee law that was passed in 2023, and it bans medical providers from giving puberty blockers and hormone therapies when meant to support a gender identity different from a person's sex assigned at birth. Now, the same treatments are available for minors when used for other medical purposes, like precocious puberty. Now, violations of the law can result in fines for healthcare providers. Now, the question for the court was whether or not Tennessee's law violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause because it says that some people can use hormone therapies and puberty blockers, but other people cannot. Now, I want to point out here something I've mentioned in past episodes, which is there was another claim that I think could come back to the court and was previously part of this case, which is that the parents had a liberty interest in being able to direct their children's medical care. That claim was not at issue in this case, but I do think it could come back up to the court. And I think that there's a possibility that the court would see that through a very different lens than the Equal Protection Clause case that's before us here. So again, issue today, did Tennessee's law violate the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause? The challengers argue that it does. The challengers were three transgender teens, their families, and a medical provider. And they said that the Tennessee law discriminates based on sex and transgender status. It therefore violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. Tennessee says this law is neutral on its face. It's aimed at protecting minors. What does the majority conclude? The majority agrees with Tennessee. Chief Justice John Roberts writes an opinion saying that the law does not violate the 14th Amendment. And this is a 6-3 decision. Again, the court is divided along its familiar conservative to liberal ideological lines. So the big question for the court was, what is this law a classification on the basis of? Is it a classification on the basis of sex or transgender status or age or medical use? If this is a classification on the basis of sex, then we know that what the court is supposed to use is something called a heightened scrutiny. They're supposed to look with a more searching eye at this law to see if it will survive. If instead, as the court ended up concluding, this is a classification based on age or medical use, then the court basically defers to the state and uses a much lower level review, something called rational basis. So the majority of the court, again, Chief Justice John Roberts, says that the Tennessee law incorporates two classifications. First, the court says the law classifies on the basis of age, because healthcare providers can administer certain medical treatments to individuals 18 and older, but not to minors. Second, the majority says that the Tennessee law classifies on the basis of medical use, again, because healthcare providers can administer puberty blockers or hormone treatments to minors to treat certain conditions like precocious puberty, but not to treat gender dysphoria. And so having concluded that the Tennessee law creates classifications on the basis of age or medical use, the court says we're going to use a deferential level of review. We're going to use rational basis, and the law survives. Now, if we look at Justice Sotomayor's dissent, she has a very different view of this case. She says the Tennessee law is a classification on the basis of sex and transgender status. She also says laws that discriminate on the basis of gender identity are in effect discriminating based on sex. Why does that matter? Again, because laws that discriminate based on sex are subject to a higher level of review, to less deferential review, meaning they're more likely to be invalidated. So the big question here for the court, again, was what is the classification on the basis of? And that dictates the level of scrutiny. I just want to highlight finally that, again, we see for both the majority and the dissent a very different view of the court's role here. So Justice Roberts says courts are not, quote, constitutional review boards for complex and evolving medical debates. What does he mean by that? He means we have to defer to elected lawmakers. The people of Tennessee elected the lawmakers to represent them. They passed this law. It's not for us to second guess. On the other hand, we have Justice Sotomayor saying, of course we need to be here. The court needs to protect individual rights and not abdicate its duties. Again, two very different lenses through which to view this particular question. So that is my summary of the two biggest cases of the term. The term is now over. There's so much more to look to and so many more interviews that we're looking forward to. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe.